when I'm going home, the boys won't leave the girls alone. They pull my hair, they stole my comb, but that's all right till I go home.
She's handsome, she is pretty, she's the belle of Belfast City. She is caught in a 1, 2, 3, please won't you tell me who is she?
Hello, folks, and welcome to episode 39 of Try It, You'll Like It. This is the podcast where we get together every couple of weeks and we choose a theme and then talk about a book and a movie around that theme. I'm Joseph Finn, and with me tonight we have my usual cohorts in crime, Amy Watts.
Hello.
And Randy Perry.
Hi, everyone.
And how is everyone doing tonight?
Good.
Fine.
Okay, excellent. Finally kind of warm here in Chicago, which is a little nice. It got into the 50s today.
Got into the 70s today here, and the humidity came with it. So,
hooray!
So you're just dying right now, right?
I'm living in a swamp again. It's awful.
Oh. So before we get into the theme, as we do every time, we talk about something we've been enjoying in the last couple of weeks. And Randy, would you like to go first this time?
Sure. Two quick things I wanted to mention. One, since we last recorded, Madonna has announced a world tour. Tickets went on sale. Tickets were purchased by me, and her new album came out. So it was just a very exciting couple of weeks for big gay Madonna fan Randy. The album itself is the deluxe version has 19 tracks, and with that, there's as usual when you get an album that long, there is definitely some padding that could be removed, but there are also some really good songs. And so yeah, looking forward to that, seeing her in Edmonton in October, because she can't play Calgary because our hockey arena is 35, I think, years old now and can't support certain requirements of most modern musical tours. So that's awesome.
Like what sort of requirements?
Well, in terms of weight suspension from the ceiling and things like that, like it just does have some limitations.
For what? For like speakers and things?
Speakers
and, lights?
And stuff, yeah. So Madonna's not coming, Taylor Swift's not coming, AC/DC's not coming, and a few other big acts are not coming to Calgary this year. But whatever, it doesn't really bother me because Edmonton's only 3 hours away, and I'm actually surprised that she's playing Edmonton, but I'm not going to argue about it. But that's neither here nor there. The thing that I did want to talk about for a couple of minutes this week is the new Netflix series, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which started life as a series in development for NBC from Tina Fey and her 30 Rock cohort, Robert Carlock. And NBC decided not to go forward with it, not to air it after a bunch of... Was it after all of season one had been made? I can't remember. But anyway, Netflix then, God love them, picked it up. And it is really filling nicely the 30 Rock void in the middle of my life right now. It stars Ellie Kemper, if you don't know anything about it because you don't live on Twitter. It stars Ellie Kemper as Kimmy Schmidt, who had been kidnapped by a religious cult leader and lived in a bunker for 15 years thinking with a few other women thinking that the apocalypse had happened and the rest of the world had been destroyed. And then once she is rescued, she moves to New York, and it is about her sort of starting her life again in New York. And it sounds kind of heavy, but it's really not. It's got that 30 Rock style of humor, just the absurd gags, the absurd cutaway gags, the running references that will occur through certain episodes. And because Kimmy herself has like missed 15 years of pop culture and of world events and stuff like that, there's just a number of references that, you know, made sense to her when she was like a teenager that are now just completely dated, but she still thinks are current. And Ellie Kemper is hilarious. And what's his name? Titus Burgess, who plays Titus in the show. He is a riot. And the show is very funny. And if you're on Netflix and you haven't watched it yet, I don't know what's wrong with you. But totally check it out. 13 episodes. Very, very funny stuff.
Excellent. And I actually have an excuse for why I have not gotten to it yet. It's because I'm still working my way through 6 seasons of backlog of Parks and Recreation. Currently on midway through season 4, midway, probably about 2/3 of the way through it, which is the Leslie's Running for City Council season. Still loving it. I don't feel I need to go on too much about just how great the show actually is. What I do want to talk about is something that Randy had mentioned. When was TIFF? Back in September?
September, yes.
Yes. When you got the chance to see it back then, and I finally caught up with it since it came out in the States February 14th weekend, I finally caught on video on demand the last 5 years, which I reservedly loved. How's that?
Oh.
I have one issue that unfortunately I have to say is a little serious for this particular movie. Before I get to that, I really, really like Anna Kendrick and Jeremy Jordan in this. Jeremy Jordan, I've only seen in bad stuff so far, so it's really nice to see that he can move beyond Smash and whatever that Hope and Glory. What the hell was that Queen Latifah movie he was in?
Joyful Noise.
Joyful Noise, thank you. It's really nice to see that with good material, he can deliver good acting. Because, wow, that other stuff wasn't showing off his skills very well. But he's good in this. It's like, wow, you're a dick. I think it's a really good movie. I just have the one problem, which takes it down a little bit. Mostly in the middle of it, I think it's not as clear as it could be as to whose timeline you're looking at. And I think especially in the middle of the movie, where you have to be very clear about whose timeline you're in as their timelines intersect. And for folks who forget, the movie is two people and their marriage and their meeting, but they're moving in opposite directions time-wise throughout the movie. She starts at the end, he starts at the beginning, and they intersect in the middle when they get married. And I think in that middle portion, when you're not quite sure whose timeline you're in, I think it can get a little muddled, and I think that's a bit of a problem. But besides that, totally recommending the movie. Really worth checking out. You can find it on VOD at the moment, guys.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that that Jamie, or Jeremy Jordan's character, Jamie, is a dick, because I think the whole point of the movie is, because the movie starts brilliantly with Anna Kendrick's Kathy singing Still Hurting, which is about her just trying to realize the fact that her husband has left her. And then throughout the movie, you find out like the reasons why their marriage fell apart and things like that. And people tend to be Team Kathy, but I think there are also valid reasons why their marriage fell apart that she is partially responsible for.
Oh, I'm not denying that at all. And I totally agree with you on that.
Yeah. And that you can see that they both wish it had sort of been different than how it was. And Jamie realizes he has fucked everything up, but that he's not 100% responsible for their marriage falling apart.
Yeah.
Which is all I'll say about it, since it's not that it's a plot heavy movie really. And everyone still needs to see it because it's wonderful.
Yeah. And I think there are points in that song, which is what, her second song, maybe third song, A Summer in Ohio.
It's about her, I think, her fourth song, third or fourth. Yeah.
But the one where she's singing to him over basically over a video chat.
Yes. Yes. And she's doing summer stock theater in Ohio.
Right. Yeah. I think there are certain pauses in that song that indicate both of their unhappiness with it that I think are very telling.
Yeah.
And it's not the most groundbreaking cinematography wise movie, but there are some very nice little touches like that that I think are worth noting.
And there is some really subtle, strong filmmaking in it too. Like there's one of Jamie's songs. I think it's called "If I Didn't Believe in You." It's one of his songs towards the end where they have the fight in the apartment.
Yeah.
It's almost one long take, and Jeremy Jordan is singing live throughout it, and the camera kind of follows them around the apartment, and it's just, it is really solid filmmaking without being showy.
Yes.
And most of the singing in the movie is done live, just in certain cases, like the scene where they were driving to meet her parents. Obviously, if you're driving in a convertible, you're not going to be able to adequately film that with them singing live. But most of the singing is actually performed live while they were actually recording or filming, which is great and really adds like the intimacy to the story.
Yeah. Okay. Amy, do you have anything for us?
No.
Oh, okay. Amy's got nothing.
I feel
nothing.
Bad. It's like the second week in a row that we finished watching Agent Carter. It was good. I hope there's a season two.
So do I, because I want Dottie back.
We're currently in the middle of watching The Americans, but we're a couple of episodes behind.
As am I.
So, it's like it's so I just don't good. Have a whole lot to say about anything, really.
Let me ask you about Americans in terms of where you are. Has Clark
I
gone over
the episode with Paige's birthday dinner?
Oh, okay. I am an episode ahead of you then.
Yeah.
Paige, your master manipulator birthday dinner.
Oh my gosh. And I just finished I'm slowly working my way through Flash and Arrow, but I'm way behind on those.
Okay.
Y'all, I just watch a lot of crap, so it's not worth talking about here. I mean, it's crap I enjoy, but it's not something that I would foist on anyone else.
Yeah, you need to catch up on Flash before the hiatus ends next week, because there's good shit.
I watch it with Melissa, and she doesn't live with me anymore, and so now it's a matter of getting her over here to watch it. And I'm continuing to watch Bob's Burgers, which I enjoy. So it's like I'm kind of catching up a little bit here and there on everything.
Let's move on to our theme for the week then. And this time around, I had the theme, and I decided since as we tape this, we are 6 days away. Yeah, 6 days away from St. Patrick's Day. You should be listening to this the day before St. Patrick's Day, or as nobody calls it, St. Patrick's Eve. And I decided that I wanted a book and a movie about Ireland, but I wanted it with a twist. I wanted urban Ireland. None of the rural stuff, no Waking Ned Divine, nothing like that. So, we had a book and a movie. Let's see, Amy had the book and Randy had the movie. Do you guys have a preference of who wants to go first?
Let's do the movie first.
Okay. Randy.
So the movie that I picked was John Ford's 1936 movie, The Informer. It's a notable movie for a number of reasons. One, it's a John Ford movie. Two, it won him his first of four Best Director Oscars. And it won a schwack of Oscars. It won Oscars for him and for lead actor Victor McLaughlin as well, and a couple of others. Now, The Informer takes place in 1922 Dublin, and it takes place over the course of one night as a former IRA, I don't really want to call him a soldier because I think his role was just more of a shit disturber anyway. Gippo Nolan is his name in the movie, played by Victor McLaughlin. He had been kicked out of the IRA, and he is sort of at the end of his rope, and he has no money. He has no job. He has a girlfriend who, by all appearances, is a prostitute, and he really has nowhere to go in his life. When he sees a wanted poster for his best friend, Frankie McPhillip, and that the reward is £20, and he and his girlfriend Katie can use this £20 reward to travel to America and start a new life. And so the movie takes place over the course of one night as Gippo decides what he wants to do, if he can actually be an informer and turn in his pal Frankie. And if so, then what he can do with the money, and if he and Katie can get away and make a fresh start of it. Now, if you think in broad terms of John Ford's place in movie history, you may think of him as a Western director. Well, Ford himself famously said, like, something like, "My name is Ford, I make Westerns." One of the ironies of his career is that of the four times he won Best Director at the Oscars, none of those movies were Westerns. So he has had a much more diverse career than just stuff like She Wore a Yellow Ribbon and The Searchers and stuff like that. Not that his Westerns aren't good, because he probably is the best director of Westerns, period. But movies like this and The Quiet Man and The Grapes of Wrath and How Green Was My Valley show a much broader set of skills than we might default think that he has.
Wait, win one for Stagecoach?
No, he did not.
That's bullshit.
Stagecoach was 39, wasn't it? Or was that 40?
Around there.
because he won, if it was 40, he won for Grapes of Wrath that year. Because back in the day, like, they directed a lot more movies than they do now. Like, there were movies, like, there was, like, 2-year period where he had, like, 4 or 5 movies listed. And so this is also stylistically much different than we associate with Ford's later work. Not just his Westerns, but much of his later work has big outdoor vistas, and the landscape becomes a huge part of the story and stuff like that. This is a much more expressionistic movie, where it seems much more linked to the history of silent movies and the German expressionism of like the 20s and early 30s as well. A big movie that this reminded me of, and I was trying to see if it had been talked about anywhere online, is Fritz Lang's M, where it feels like the walls are just closing in on the main character. And so this is a very expressionistic movie, lots of really dark scenes, lots of shadows and fog, and just really gorgeous dark black and white photography. And it's also a very dark movie too. I was looking at a couple of articles online that rightly cited as a precursor to the film noir of the 1940s, where they've also called Gippo almost one of the first anti-heroes in movies, which I thought was also a fascinating characterization as well, and totally makes sense in the context of the character and of the movie to see him that way. And we can talk about the movie's Ireland as well, because I think it's interesting to talk about the movie's importance in Ford's career as it is the movie in its setting and its story at the same time. But first, I'll turn it over to you guys to get your initial thoughts on the movie. Amy.
I found this is one of those things that it's very hard sometimes for me to... I'm such a modern girl, if that makes sense.
I know. I figured you would say this, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, and that's not a criticism of it. I mean, and it's a criticism of me more likely that, and I have a hard time sometimes. I mean, it's not just movies. It can be anything, you know, books or music or whatever. They're from such a different time and such a different, manner. That's not the right word, but you know what I mean.
There's a style to the acting as well.
Like style to the acting. I mean, I have to tell you, at the beginning, I thought, wait a minute, is this a silent film? Because
I had that thought too, actually.
I mean, but then I thought, wait a minute, no, we heard somebody singing. But then I thought, well, maybe he was singing over, you know, maybe that's like added in later as part of the, you know what I mean? Because at the very beginning, when you have that scene where you've got the guy that comes up to her at the streetlight, you know, the John propositioning her at the streetlight. And then Gippo comes over, and I mean, like, so much of that is done without dialogue at the very beginning that it played almost like a silent film. And you know, given when this was made, I think you can certainly see a lot of carryover in terms of the style of silent filmmaking into this film, even though it was a talkie. Overall, though, I mean, it's not... It was a good movie, but it's not going to be a favorite of mine because I don't really respond well to, like, kind of, I guess, the very serious melodrama. Is that the right, does that seem like a fair way of describing it?
I
don't mean melodrama as a criticism. I mean it as, you know, there is zero irony in this.
Yeah.
You know, there isn't even really much in the way of humor. I mean, it is straight up, you know, going for the emotional gut punch drama.
Yeah. And I think with the style of acting as well, very melodramatic. And I think that also ties it in much with the silent film styles as well. Like this, I think if you watch this as a silent movie, and we're aware of the story, so you didn't have the intertitle cards. it would play, it might actually play better, just because some of it can, to modern audiences at least, come across as very overwrought.
Oh, shut your gob.
And I honestly, Randy, I think you're onto something there. I think that last scene with him yelling out, Frankie, he's forgiven, she's forgiven me, yeah, and then dying, that would totally play
spoiler
with title
alert
cards. It's a
oh,
19,
come on.
It's a 80-year-old movie.
The other thing, though, that I do think was interesting in terms of like a filmmaking / cinematography point of view thing was, I remember a million years ago when I took a film class, them talking about with Citizen Kane, how Citizen Kane was revolutionary for its some of its deep focus cinematography.
Yes. Yeah.
And I never really thought about what that meant until I was watching this movie, and you could see scenes where, you know, whoever was speaking was in the foreground, and all the people in the background, they weren't blurry in that kind of way that you're used to things being blurry.
Yeah.
But they were blurry because you just, it made me realize, oh, they literally could not, this was the only way it could be filmed.
Right.
Well,
see, that was kind of interesting in terms of like, you know, a little history lesson for Amy, yeah, on the technicality of cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and also like when Orson Welles, in response to talking about Citizen Kane afterwards, he, like when asked how he prepared for the movie, he said, I prepared by watching films by the old masters, by which I mean John Ford, John Ford, John Ford. I know he cited Stagecoach as an explicit reference point for much of Citizen Kane, but it wouldn't surprise me if this was one of them as well. And I'm not sure if Grapes of Wrath would have been too close in time to have been studied by Welles when he was making Kane. Probably not. But yeah, Kane, Citizen Kane, great movie, but I think it wrongly gets credit for things that people like John Ford and the cinematographer Greg Toland, who didn't work on this but worked on other Ford movies, stuff that they had been doing, but Welles just kind of put it all together. And not to take anything away from Citizen Kane,
Welles found the cinematographer and equipment. I mean, I think in a lot of sense it was a technological advance,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yes. And one thing I would like to say about this movie, that in terms of not feeling as modern in its cinematography, this movie was done on the incredible cheap.
Yes.
I mean, if you look at the sets, that's basically some walls and a couple of room interiors. You could probably fit the sets for this in my apartment, frankly.
Well, the other thing I noticed that was kind of funny was right at the beginning of the movie when the newspaper is going across the... Or not newspaper, but like the piece
sign
of paper, the one, it's, I guess it's a bill, you know,
yeah,
post no bills bill. And it's so clearly on a string or something. Like it was, or I don't know, it was like there was something off about it that almost made me check my, you know, pop out the DVD and check to make sure that something wrong, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's just like you realize, well, somebody had to figure out how to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this is early days cinema, and that may have, you know, I'm not saying it is, but it's like no one had figured out how to do it better yet.
Right.
You know?
And there's a couple of things that if it had been made like 10 years later, for instance, there's a couple of Frankie's seeing the bill up again on a wall where it had been torn down by him before, or yeah, he's envisioning going to America with Katie. I'm not sure what you exactly would call those shots. Overlays?
Double exposure?
Yeah. Double exposure. Thank you, Randy. That don't quite work to our modern eyes just because it's stuff that was still relatively new in cinema,
yeah, and
in post-production.
There's nothing subtle about it either. Like it's...
Oh, no. This movie is about the least subtle thing.
Yeah, and I don't mean that as, you know, an insult or anything. Like, it's just... Ford is often not really a subtle director anyway. But yeah, it's as a time capsule of the kind of leading edge of filmmaking, American filmmaking techniques in the mid-30s, this is a pretty good time capsule.
Yeah, and it's Ford, and is, you know, let's be frank, his little habit of being slightly, writing the myth about Irish people.
That's fair.
Although I have to say, in some ways, like, this movie did not feel at all Irish to me. I mean, it did, but it didn't. I'm like, this is a story that you could have set in so many different conflicts, in so many different, you know, it's essentially, don't rat out your friends.
Yeah. And in fact, and the novel was made, this is the second version that was filmed of the novel. The first one was a British production about 6 years earlier, I think.
Yeah, it sounds about right.
Well, because the moral was, don't rat out your friends.
Probably.
I mean, you know what I mean? It's like, I thought it was interesting that even though, yes, it is set in Ireland and everything like that, it didn't, at least to me, feel like it had any distinctly... Or maybe I missed it, you know, since this is something you're more... I mean, aside from the accents and whatever, but, you know, it's like... Yeah. There wasn't a twist to the story that made it specifically Irish.
No, yeah, I mean, just you put the slap a setting on of the IRA and the Black and Tans, who, by the way, were more of a rural thing. They weren't especially an urban commando thing. Anyway, and boom, you've got an Irish movie.
Right.
And then you can have the fun of noting that almost every actor in this movie is British.
Yes.
I think the only Irish person in the movie specifically is the one who plays Frankie McPhillip's mother.
And I have to say, on the subject, you know, he won the Academy Award for this performance.
Yes, he did.
Yes.
You know who he beat out?
Not offhand, no.
Two. Well, one I have not seen, but I imagine it was probably a more interesting this. Clark Gable for The Caine Mutiny.
Eh.
William Powell for The Thin Man.
Now, see, that we need to talk about, Will Victor McLaughlin.
I mean, I guess some people feel like, well, you know, what's the acting in The Thin Man? And I'm like, oh, really?
It's because he makes it look damn effortless.
You know, it's the whole thing of comedy has never gotten the respect it deserves.
Yeah, I don't begrudge Victor McLaughlin as Oscar because I've always been a huge fan of his in the John Ford movies. I love him in the Ford Apache movies. Love him in The Quiet Man. The other stuff that I can't remember right now. I think he's a fantastic actor. But going against William Powell and The Thin Man, oh, that's a totally different story.
He did not. He won. William Powell, empty-handed. Well, probably not empty-handed, but
no, he had an Oscars.
No, I mean William Powell had probably a drink
sorry.
In one hand and his companion for the evening in the other. But you know.
Yeah, exactly.
I was trying to think of a non-vulgar way to say that, and you came up with it.
I would love. Hitting the cinematography one more time, I would love to get a restored version of this movie because I'm not quite sure whether some of the fuzziness is just due to age or how it actually looked in 1935.
Yeah, I don't know if this has actually been remastered. It doesn't appear to have been.
Right.
So I don't know. Speaking of remastered Ford movies, Joe, do you have The Quiet Man on Blu-ray or on DVD?
No, actually.
Okay, because I was just curious because I had bought the DVD about a decade ago when it came out, and it was a shit transfer. But
I remember that transfer. It is shit.
Oh, my God. But I think I was just curious if you had the more recent Blu-ray to just know if it was actually worth buying.
If there's a more recent one, I know there's a TCM print that they use every year that looks fantastic.
Oh, okay.
So I can only hope that somebody has put out a better one. Actually, TCM might sell a DVD of Quiet Man.
I know
if they do,
I
would look for that one.
Yeah, it is out on Blu-ray and DVD. It came out a couple years ago, but just I haven't really researched it to see if it's worth getting or not.
Yeah,
but speaking of The Quiet Man, one of my – Joe, I know it's a favorite movie of yours. There was essays. I just came across some essays talking about The Informer that I just thought I'd read one passage of it just to get Joe angry at us for a couple of minutes.
Oh, good. Poke the bear.
When Ford next returned to Ireland, it would be in The Quiet Man, a lush, beautifully photographed but vapid fantasy which showcased Ford at his worst and most self-indulgent.
All right.
I'm like, you kind of lose me there because... You know, The Quiet Man is awesome. End of sentence. Like, there's just...
Who was this, Pauline Kael? She hated fun.
No, this was just some Yahoo.
Oh, somebody on Yahoo Answers? Even better. Well,
no, it wasn't on Yahoo Answers. It was just some Yahoo on the internet.
Okay. I firmly acknowledge that my taste in The Quiet Man is not shared by everyone.
But it's shared with everyone who has good taste, because The Quiet Man is awesome.
Exactly. Maureen O'Hara, for crying out loud.
Never see it.
I don't think you would like The Quiet Man.
Wait, go back and replay the statement you just made. It's liked by anyone with good taste. And then I say I haven't seen it, and you say I don't think you'd like it.
I can see why you made that connection.
Randy, I see how it works. I know how you feel about me now.
There are story elements in The Quiet Man that I expect you would not react well to.
I assume it's a Western in Ireland, and, you know, me and Westerns.
No.
Not really, no.
No.
Oh, okay.
It's more about taming the wild redheaded woman.
Oh.
Also taming the wild redheaded guy.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
Yeah. He's redheaded in the short story. It's John Wayne. He's not redheaded.
About to say, since when does John Wayne have red hair?
Yeah. But it has a 15-minute fist fight between John Wayne and Victor McLaughlin.
Oh, boy. That's wonderful.
It's the second greatest fight in movie history.
Dare I ask first? What you think is the first?
Oh, it's obviously it's Roddy Roddy Piper and Keith David in They Live.
Oh, obviously.
Yes. Third is the match at the end of Rocky.
I have seen none of these.
Wait, you've never seen Rocky?
No, I know the gist.
I've heard piano being played. I know the gist of Mozart.
Well, no, I mean, you know, guy, streets, comes up from, woman, trainer, steps. Got it.
Is it possible to appreciate Rocky, Randy, without bringing in Cousin Polly?
I like but don't love Rocky, so I might not be the best person to ask.
Fair enough. Okay. All right.
The
you know
only
what?
Rocky I've ever been tempted to see is the one with Dolph Lundgren, because my love for Dolph knows no bounds.
That is a cheese-tastic movie.
Yes. It was one of those, like, well, it was 1984 when Rocky IV came out, and that was, you know, like, applauding in theaters because the Russian gets his ass kicked. Like, it was doing that, you know, in small-town Canada.
But it's aged. I think it's aged a different way, just in the sense that now you're kind of not rooting so much against the Russian guy.
Well, I wouldn't root against him in the first place because he's my beloved Dolph. See, there's no problem. I'd be like, no, don't hurt the pretty!
All right, before we move to the book, Amy, I will just tell you, watch on YouTube, watch at least, or if it's on Netflix, watch the training montage in Rocky IV, because it is almost the epitome of an 80s training montage. Just all the way through. Cheesy anthem and goofy exercises. And running away from the KGB in the snow. It's weird. But anyway, Amy, you had the book, so let's skip on over to that. How's that go for you?
Well, I will. And since we last recorded, I had to change my original book selection because Joe and I were finding it a bit difficult to obtain through free methods, and we're cheap like that. So I switched us from one Colin Bateman to another one, this Divorcing Jack, which turns out to be the first in a series of books featuring the journalist Starkey. What's Starkey's first name?
Dan
Starkey. It's set in Belfast in 1995, and it's got a convoluted plot, but let's just say that you've got a journalist who gets mixed up in things bigger than he could have ever imagined. I'm not saying my pick was better than Randy's. That's not what I'm saying. Because what I'm saying, though, is that I felt like this definitely had a very Irish, like, I felt like it in a lot of ways told a story that there wouldn't be a lot of other places you could tell this story this way. Except for, like, maybe some places in the Middle East where there have been conflicts going on as long as this one. Because it turns out before the story is over that you're looking at events from 20 years ago still affecting modern Ireland. And in the end, events that will continue to shape the future of Ireland as it is at the end of the book. It's definitely reminded me a little bit of, I think I read a description somewhere of Colin Bateman as being the Irish equivalent of Carl Hiaasen. And I can see that. I could also see a little bit of Elmore Leonard, maybe. Maybe not writing at the same level as Elmore Leonard, but in terms of, you know, crime and, you know, people going on the lam and everybody getting beat up and stuff like that. I could definitely see the resemblance there. It definitely had some, I will say it had some attempts more successful than other at humor. I think it, a lot, you know, as with most things humorous, it depends on your taste. You either buy a shtick or you don't. And I'd say I bought it maybe 50% of the time. What did you guys think?
Like you said, feeling like it's a Leonard or a Carl Hiaasen novel. I also thought about Raymond Chandler, who's always my go-to in this kind of story. When you have somebody who's not quite sure what the hell what's going on, stumbling through a story that the reader might not even quite understand at the end. But
yeah,
that may
that.
Not be the point.
I think it's just Leonard and Hiaasen both have a sort of madcap, may not be quite the right word, but... You know, there's definitely more craziness. I mean, you know, he gets picked up in the story at one point by a singing nun who's actually a nurse.
Right.
And just does a little striptease in the nun costume as a nunogram.
Which, you know, makes perfect sense.
That doesn't feel like something out of Raymond Chandler, but definitely feels like something, you know, you could find the equivalent of in Leonard or Hiaasen or something like that.
Right. But besides that, it does feel more inherently Irish. I mean, by my rough count, I think there's about 7 sides in this novel, including Starkey, because you have you've got the IRA, you've got the alt, the Unionists, the Loyalists, the Unionists, Loyalists. God damn it, what's the other one?
Republicans?
No, Unionists, Loyalists.
There's some Republicans in there.
There's Republicans. Damn it, there's another big one that I'm trying to... we'll just call them Republicans. I can't think of another term right now. You've got the Brits who are still hanging around. You've got the local police. You've got the local politicians.
You even get the Americans in there, which, you know, when I was looking up some of the terms and history, this is right around the same time that Clinton starts to put a big push into Ireland, even appointing someone to go over there as in more than just name, to be like, hey, we're America. Let us help you straighten this shit out.
Right. As I remember, former Senator Mitchell and the Good Friday Accords.
Yeah.
Which I believe might have been the year before this. And is referred to cynically by Starkey in the end that I forget the exact term, but it's something like the world gave us a pat on the back and we all got a Nobel Prize for it.
So it's a, you know, it's a little, it's, you, I thought it was an interesting, they bring America in the form of a reporter who's there to interview the, well, again, I didn't do a whole lot of research into Irish politics, but it struck me that it works a little bit like what I know of in the UK, where you have
a
party that gets elected.
And yeah, this is the UK, so that works perfectly fine.
Well, but I mean, they're saying prime minister, and it wouldn't be prime minister of the United Kingdom, was it?
No, prime minister of Belfast, of Northern Ireland.
Ireland.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's why I made the distinction there. So anyway.
Leaving that aside, I liked it.
I was gonna say it's one of those things where you don't elect a man, you elect a party.
Right.
But it's pretty clear who the party will then install as prime minister. So essentially you have a candidate for prime minister that's being interviewed by this American journalist.
Right. But as I was saying, I liked it quite a bit. I'm not sure that I would read any more of these Dan Starkey novels. I think this is a perfectly fine one and done for me.
Yeah.
But I think it's a pretty effective thriller, even if I honestly did figure out what happened, what was going to be going on about a third of the way through. I just wasn't quite sure who was trying to get the up on who at various points. It's like there's a cassette tape that comes in about a God, maybe only a quarter of the way through, and I'm like, all right, I think I've got where you're going with this.
Yeah, see, I did not spot Chekhov's cassette tape.
Sure it wasn't Dvorak's cassette tape? Yeah, the title comes from a dying person trying to say Dvorak, and it comes out as divorcing Jack, which I'm not quite sure works
Dvorak
as a...
Dvorak, or what's the other one that has starts with a B that sounds a lot like that? Bartok.
Bartok, yeah.
I can't remember which one's which, but there was one of them that was so awful, I left at halftime, intermission of a symphony performance, and it was pouring rain outside. I mean, it was like, you know, build an ark kind of rain, and the person I'd gone to the symphony with and I, we'd both forgotten our umbrellas, and we decided to risk drowning rather than go back in for the second half. But I don't remember now if it was Dvorak or Bartok. So I always feel now I'm afraid that if I don't say I like either one of them because I'm afraid it'll be the one I didn't like.
Bartok was Hungarian. Dvorak was Czech.
Which one just made a lot of noise?
Neither.
One of them was experimental.
Well, Bartok probably was a little more experimental, but he also did a lot of folk music repurposing.
Yeah, I think he was the good.
Ah, Bartok, brilliant. His bear dances, I believe they're called, are fantastic.
Oh, Jesus.
So, Randy, now that we're past that discussion, what did you think?
I liked it. It wasn't heavy, and I mean that in a good way. Like that, because it's dealing with the troubles and ongoing difficulties in Irish history, it the book is pretty light on its feet. It felt more like a page-turner thriller rather than, you know, a difficult, important history lesson, which I mean as a compliment, because for me personally, I'd rather read a page-turner.
Well, I think that's Colin Bateman's general thing.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I liked that it was 250 pages and that there were, 33 chapters, so it was nice short chapters, which made it easier to do that whole, I'll just read one more thing, which just helps make it easier to get through. One thing that I also appreciated, often when foreigners, that's not the word I want to look for, and I don't want to just use the word Americans, but when an author is writing dialogue in either a language or a dialect that's not his or her own, the author tends to get cute with it, in terms of just like how they'll like abbreviate words and use the loose punctuation and stuff like that. And, you know, we've seen it any number of times. And, you know, it's not always a bad thing because, you know, think of how like Mark Twain writes Joe and Huck Finn. Jim and Huck Finn. Joe. Where the hell did that go?
Well, it was like me with the Lady Chatterley.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's another perfect example. Whereas here, you know, it's an Irish writer writing about Irish people, and he just writes their dialogue, you know, using words rather than trying to make it like different or difficult to comprehend or anything like that. So, you know, I definitely also appreciated that because for me, that's one of those things that can get in the way of enjoying a story. And I wouldn't expect him to do it here because he's writing about, you know, he's Irish and writing about Irish people, or Northern Irish, however the case may be. Yeah, and I enjoyed it. I thought, like, it definitely had its funny bits, and some of the dialogue, especially with the before things got too serious and people started turning up dead, it was crisp and definitely easy and fun to read. I give it a B-. No, yeah.
What was you saying? So did you enjoy? I mean, like Ray Starkey. I think you have. What did you feel about the Ray Starkey shtick?
Dan Starkey.
Dan. I don't know why I keep calling him Ray. There's an actor named Ray Starkey, isn't there?
I think the name sounds familiar. What do you mean the shtick?
Well, I mean, just his whole persona. That kind of, you know, gruff, sarcastic reporter who drinks too much kind of thing. I shouldn't say reporter, I should say columnist. But, You know what I mean? Like, his brand of a sense of humor, I guess.
Yeah. That worked for me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it avoided the, in other novels, I think this could have been the, oh, he has never grown up and he's really pissing off everyone about it. But it seems to me that, frankly, in his circle of friends and with his wife, they're all pretty much in the same boat. So it's not like he's the outlier there. There's a little bit of an indication that his wife would like him to grow up a little bit, but nothing that's too serious. Well, until she finds him canoodling with another woman at a party, but I think it's pretty apparent that that's the only time that's ever happened before.
You know, I found it a little wearying at times, which is why
I found the cynicism a little wearying at times.
I found his cynicism perfectly understandable, but some of the, I don't know, the sort of raggedy edges. I don't know. I mean, maybe I just wasn't in the right mood for it or something. But I think I think whether or not you like Dan Starkey's personality. I think whether or not you like Dan Starkey's personality would probably be the big thing that would determine whether or not you like the book in general. I mean, if you like thrillers and you pick this one up, but if you did not like him, you know, there's such a strong personality. A lot of times with these thrillers, the lead can almost be bland.
Uh-huh.
And so I think that I don't know. I kind of appreciate Bateman going a little bit on the limb and making a character that's a little bit more unusual. Not unusual, but, you know, not divisive. That's not the right word. But, you know, I could definitely see people picking it up and getting through the first chapter and being like, I do not care what happens to this piece of shit. And I could picture other people picking it up and being like, this guy's a riot. I want to see how he makes it to the end. Because if you're like us and you know this is the number one in a series, you're pretty sure he's going to make it to the next one.
Yeah, I think like going back to not Hyacinth, but you guys are going to have to help me here. Who is the sometime detective who lives on a boat? Author's last name is McDonald, down in the Florida somewhere.
I think that's Miami Vice.
Jesus.
Lives on a boat. Does he have an alligator?
Wasn't it the Simpsons spinoff showcase too? Wasn't that where Chief Wiggum lived? No, that was in New Orleans.
That was in New Orleans on a houseboat. And the houseboat was owned by the big boss, as I remember.
Yes, yes.
And maybe an old friend will help him, will stop by to help him out. Keep an eye out. Anyway. But yeah, I'm kind of glad we all like this novel. I think we've had a couple of weeks in a row where one or the other of us wasn't so big on one thing. So I think we've had a pretty positive week this week. Go team.
Well, I mean, I'm not adding either one of these to my favorites list, but I didn't find either one of them excruciating, so yay!
Yay, Team Venture. All right. So for next time around, Amy had the theme, I believe?
I do. Notes.
Yes, okay. Go ahead, Amy.
I have the theme, and shameless self-promotion, it's my birthday coming up. Actually, I think what's today's date?
Today's the 11th.
Yeah, so we'll be recording on my birthday, unless we move it. So, that was your theme, was birthday.
All right, Randy, you have the movie.
It's all about me.
It's always all about you.
Yes.
Last time it was cats, this time it's birthdays. I just picked up crocheting, fair warning.
Oh, God. We're going to have to do an evening shade episode.
Anyway, all right. So, birthday. I believe, Randy, I want Randy to do the second one. So, Joe, what are you picking for the book?
Are you
with the giant long one?
No, I'm not. I am.
And it's my birthday and everything.
I'm giving you a novel that is only slightly longer than what we just read. So, there.
All right. What is it?
I'm giving you, it turns out that both of you have seen the movie, but I don't care because the novel's great and there are significant differences.
To which I am referring. All right.
Yes. So we are going to be reading the novel, the original, of The Namesake by Jhumpa Lahiri. which is about as close as I can get to her name. Sorry about that if I'm completely mangling that. I only know Lahiri because Mindy Kaling, her character in the Mindy Project, as that last name is a tribute to her. A lot of people who saw the movie, maybe not everyone, but she did win the did she win the Pulitzer Prize for this or the Interpreter of Maladies, now that I think about it?
I think Namesake.
Okay. I think it's a fantastic... No, it's definitely the Namesake or Interpreter of Maladies, one of the first two. It's a wonderful novel about a boy named Gogol, who's the son of a... I believe they're Punjabi, but I could be wrong. Family who has moved from Calcutta to Massachusetts, and how he grows up in Massachusetts with... they're either Bengali or Punjabi. I'm sorry that I'm stuck on this in my head. She writes about both groups. And it's just, I think, a really, really interesting novel about the immigrant experience from a for an immigrant group that just doesn't get written about that much in the U.S. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what you guys think of the novel, especially since you've both seen the movie, which, for those who have not seen it, Cal Penn, really good in a dramatic role in that.
Do you want to tell me how it fits into the theme, since it's not obvious to me?
There are plenty of birthdays in it.
Okay.
Yes.
I mean, other than just the fact that the person ages?
Well, and there are birthdays. And birthday parties.
Okay. Because I was like, any book that lasts longer than a year is going to have a birthday in it. You know.
I interpreted your saying for birthdays as that you wanted birthday parties or celebrations of some kind, and there are birthdays in here, so there.
Okay, I'm just double-checking. I didn't know if you were just stretching it to be like, he ages, therefore he must have had birthdays.
Hey, my choice for cats was Alien, and I think that one worked out pretty darn well.
Well, but that fit the criteria perfectly fine.
Yep, so cut me some slack.
Cat is a significant character in that book, a movie. All right.
In terms of making Sigourney Weaver do dumb things, yes.
That saved her life.
Yes.
Well, she wakes up and the cat's a face sucker. I'm still sure that's what happened.
Oh, we still have to watch Aliens sometime.
We do.
I haven't seen the sequel, but I just know that's the opening. And the pod retracts and there's a little face sucker with...
The great thing is that is not an insane idea for how Aliens would start, quite frankly.
It's kind of what happens in Alien 3, actually.
Yeah, actually, yes. All right, Randy, you had the movie.
Yeah, so with Joe's and Amy's permission, I have chosen a movie that they have both seen, but I have not. And
flipping
that
it
movie.
Around.
What's that?
Flipping it around.
Yes, and that movie is 16 Candles. I don't know why I have never seen 16 Candles. There's a lot of those 80s John Hughes-ish sort of movies that I just haven't seen. And so we are going to be watching 16 Candles. I'm assuming someone turned 16, and I'm assuming that the person who turned 16 is played by Molly Ringwald. But I know nothing else about the movie.
Well, I will tell you this, that the movie takes place on her birthday and pretty much is... Probably, I would say the whole movie is not more takes place in not more than what, about 48 hours.
That sounds about right.
Probably less than.
Yeah. So starts off on a Friday morning, goes through Saturday afternoon. Call it about 36 hours, I think.
Yeah, and most of which is her actual birthday.
Yeah.
So it is, and I will say, Randy? Do you watch Bob's Burgers?
I don't.
Okay, because there's my favorite episode so far of Bob's Burgers, which I have now watched 3 times because I keep making other people watch it, ends with has a wonderful little 16 Candles throwaway reference in it that makes me very, very happy.
And I will note with this movie, we will be 2/5 of the way through on this podcast of the John Hughes Documents My High School Experience movies. Except that I went to an all-guys high school, but I knew enough women from schools around it, so it's close enough. Because I went to a high school that is squarely in John Hughes land. Also, this is better than Weird Science.
It's one of those interesting things, because, Joe, I don't remember how many... I think you're just, like, what, 3-4 years older than me?
Sounds about right. I was born in 73.
Oh, just 2 years older than me, but it's just... you lived in a big town, a big city, and I lived in Tennessee. And so it was like I was actually probably about 6 years behind you in terms of culture, because the things I saw in John Hughes movies, it was like, whoa. You know, like, that doesn't happen here in Knoxville. So
try being from Canada.
I just assumed everything in Canada was like, you can't do that on television. And that all the, or Degrassi, it was like, Canada is either Degrassi or you can't do that on television. And frankly, that was a place I wanted to live because I had crushes on most of the boys in those two shows. So
I'm going to put in the show notes, actually, a interesting essay that went up on The Dissolve today from Jay Charney, who is exactly the same age as I am and has one or two kids. And her reactions to The Breakfast Club, watching it as an adult, I think it's a really interesting read.
Well, I mean, I will say before we go into 16 Candles, there are a lot of things in 16 Candles that will not have aged well. I can tell you that right now. So on the one hand, you know, take it for what it was when it was. But on the other hand, feel free to fairly criticize it for the things it does deserve the criticism for.
Absolutely. I think it holds up. Okay. I think it holds up. I mean, all right. I'm not going to prejudice it. I'm not going to talk any more about it. So does anyone have any closing thoughts, lambastings over the movie choices?
I do want to point out that I was, if you listened to the last podcast and heard me talk about Dancing with the Stars and how they still hadn't found a partner for Whitney and that they're probably going to do some bullshit like announce it was The Bachelor. Guess what got announced today?
That she's dancing with The Bachelor?
Uh-huh.
Okay, then.
Do not bet against me when it comes to Dancing with the Stars.
So his fake wife will be Gary glaring balefully from the stands for the next however many weeks?
I know. For all I know, he ended The Bachelor by giving a rose to a cactus.
When does The Bachelor pad come back?
When does what come back?
When does The Bachelor pad come back?
I don't even know what that is. I don't want to know what that is.
It was like a real-world house version of The Bachelor, except bringing various contestants together.
Well, that just sounds like a petri dish for disease.
Oh, yeah. I forget if it was both of them, but one of them was definitely Stephen Thompson wrote an essay on it that's hysterical.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's icky.
Did you guys watch this last week's Saturday Night Live with Chris Hemsworth?
Yes. I skimmed through it, yes.
There was an interesting little sketch kind of near the end that was I don't know if they labeled it as a digital short or not, but it was, so I think they called it, So You Think You Want to Live with Brian or something like that. And it was making fun of basically all reality shows simultaneously.
Yeah. Yeah. I watched that. I didn't think it was great, but I thought it was pretty good.
But the thing of it was, I was like, just the 2.5 minutes or whatever it was of that sketch, I was like, this is why I don't watch reality TV that's like that. You know, because the guy would say, so, Kyle, you want to get some takeout? And then the other one, and then you cut to the confessional where Kyle's like, so he asked me if I wanted to get takeout. I wasn't sure what to say. Cut back to the live action. I'm not sure what to say. I'm like, oh, my God, everything twice. How do you stand it?
I'm going to put this in the show notes, and this will be the last thing before we let you guys go. Over the last couple of months, they've been doing a thing in the Marvel Comics called Spider-Verse, where basically all the spiders from various dimensions have been banding together to fight this ultimate hunter of the spiders. Basically, he's trying to absorb their spider essence, blah, blah, blah. At one point, this hunter goes into the world of the Spider-Man comic book strips. The newspaper strips. And he's constantly being reset. The time resets every day so that everything's repeating, but with incremental moving forward. And he finally just leaves in disgust. And I just howled at that because, like, okay, you people know your subject. I mean, they went into everything. They went into the Japanese Spider-Man TV series of the 70s, the 60s Spider-Man cartoon, and they're all drawn in the appropriate styles. It was really, really well done. Okay, folks, so we'll be back in 2 weeks with the theme of birthdays. We'll be watching 16 Candles. We'll be reading the namesake. You, as usual, you can find us at tryandlikeit.blogspot.com. You can find me on the Twitter at Josephin, that's Josephinn. You can find Amy at Amy Watts, that's AmyWatts. And you can find Randy at Randois, that's RANDOIS. And one final question for you, Amy. Dancing with the Stars and your coverage starts next week?
It does indeed. There
Excellent.
Was no, they didn't ask me to do a preview this time, and I didn't offer because it looks like a steaming pile of shit.
And that'll be at the Baltimore Sun, and we'll have a link for you guys to where you can find that.
Actually, it will be in the Baltimore Sun, but there's also a good possibility it could be in any Tribune syndicated newspaper.
Oh, including the Chicago Tribune.
Mm-hmm. On
nice.
Their website.
Okay, folks, thanks for listening. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
In the sky, leading them is a mighty man with a mad rage in his eye. My name is James Connolly. I didn't come here to die, but to fight for the rights of the working man, the small farmer too. Protect the proletariat from the bosses and their screws. Hold on to your rifles, boy. Don't give up your dream of a republic for the working class economic liberty.